Okay, thank you very much, Rabbi Turetsky. You mentioned I am a regular at this point. It's a highlight of my Elul schedule, my pre-Rosh Hashanah preparations, is to be able to spend some time with you here in this Beis Medrash. It's a very enjoyable part of the month for me, mostly because I get introductions like that and because I'm told about all the wonderful things that I'm doing and all the good titles that I have. And it's good to go into Rosh Hashanah with a little bit of confidence sometimes and to feel good about yourself instead of beating yourself up all the time. So it's always nice for the ego to come here. Much more importantly, it's nice to be part of a community of learners and a community of growers and people who are dedicating so much of their time to so many wonderful things. Rabbi Turetsky mentioned my affiliations and how proud I am of the affiliations that I have with NCSY, which is a community of learners and a community of growers. I know we have many alumni of NCSY that are here and of NCSY summer programs. The time that I'm privileged to spend in Yeshivat Reshit Yerushalayim and the times that I'm privileged to spend visiting places like Shalvim for Women, visiting Shalvim for Women, and just being part of a people who want to take advantage of every opportunity that is placed in front of them and to grow in such a special way. It's a very, very special thing to be part of such a group and to be able to join you in such preparations before Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. And I'm always happy to be able to do it and always inspired by the opportunity to learn with you and to speak with you for a couple of minutes. Who am I? Who am I to share with you any words of chizuk, any words of inspiration or any insights? None of the things that Rabbi Turetsky described, I think, give me the right to stand here in front of you. I think the biggest claim to fame and the biggest or the most credibility that I would have in terms of being able to speak to you today would be as a person who struggles, as a person who went through and goes through so many of the challenges that many in our community face on a regular basis in terms of navigating the different areas of life that we encounter and going through the trials and tribulations that life puts in front of us, and a person who struggles to have the proper focus and to the proper energy going into Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur to be able to share with you some of those strategies and some of those things. And I think a little bit of a further introduction to who I am, and I'm not 100% comfortable, especially in a room full of almost strangers, speaking about myself. I'm not going to do it for very long, but I think a little bit more of an introduction as to who I am and the types of things that I'm into might help us along that path a little bit. We'll see if that's true or not true. So I grew up in Bergen County. I grew up in Teaneck, New Jersey, and I attended a year in Israel, then went back to America, got married. My daughter's here with me. One of my kids is with me here right now. And then about 14 years ago, we decided to make Aliyah. I've been teaching in Reshit and working with NCSY, doing stuff with the summer programs ever since. So far, nobody cares. So far, none of that matters all that much. You shouldn't be that excited. It has very little to do with what we're going to speak about tonight. I have a bunch of hobbies that I'm into. I kind of follow sports from time to time. I don't know how helpful that's going to be for our discussion tonight either. I like exploring the land of Israel. I like going on hikes. I like climbing mountains, especially when my daughters and sons accompany me. It's a good thing to do. We like playing board games. We like doing things like that. I really, really like, though, and my daughter can attest to this. She'll nod her head and tell me and tell you whether I'm making it up or not. I really, really like, in a almost weird kind of way, directions. I am very, very, you know, you have, and this is kind of I don't want to give any gender stereotypes here, but this is kind of a guy thing. Sometimes you get to a bar mitzvah or an engagement party or something like that, and the guys kind of huddle and talk about how they traveled and how they got there and whether they were able to beat Waze or not. And, you know, just give talks about, I don't know if you're any of your dads, your brothers, or your moms, or your sisters, or you yourselves engage in those kinds of conversations and activities. I'm really, really into directions, and I'm okay with telling you and sharing with you and boasting a little bit. And again, my daughter will nod or shake her head and tell you whether I'm making it up or not. I'm actually pretty good at it. Now, it doesn't help the fact that we got lost coming here today. She's probably holding back from mentioning that. We made one wrong turn, even though I've been here a lot of times before. Tried a shortcut, didn't exactly work. But I am pretty good at directions. I actually did view the development of Waze, of GPS before that, of Google Maps. I viewed that not as a benefit or as a partner, but more as competition. That was just the way I was wired. You know, I was very, very suspicious of Waze when it first came out and always wanted to see if they knew better than I knew or anything else like that. I'll just to establish my credentials with this, we took a lot of family vacations when I was younger, traveled all over the place. It happens to be that growing up, I never traveled to Florida. I know that breaks other stereotypes of Jews and what they do and where they go. It was nothing against Disney World. It was nothing against Miami. Growing up, we went to all sorts of places across America. We never traveled to Florida. I had never been to Florida in my life until I was a sophomore in Yeshiva University. A friend of mine got married to a girl from Florida. The wedding was in Florida, and I flew down for the day. I was 20 years old. I flew down for the day to Florida. I took a cab from the airport to the wedding hall, which was in Miami Beach, and then a cab back on the way back to New York. About 7 years later, I went to Florida for the second time in my life. I was married at that point. I went down with my wife for vacation. My wife's grandmother, who's since passed away, Alel Lushala, my wife's grandmother, lived in Miami Beach. Now, this was pre-GPS, Waze, and anything else like that. We took a flight to New York, down to Miami International Airport, and as soon as we got to the rental car place, my wife said, oh my gosh, it was a night flight, it was about 10:45, 11 o'clock at night, and she said, all week long I had on my list to call my grandmother and ask her for directions to the airport. Now, we don't know what to do, and it wasn't even the type of internet apps that you could use for that. I don't even know how to get there, at all. And I said to her, don't worry, I know exactly how to get there. And she said, that's not possible. You've never been there before. You don't even know. I said, just give me the address. When we came here, when I went here 7 years ago for that wedding in that cab, I just made a mental map of Miami and Miami Beach, and I can get to her house. And I did. I drove to her house without a problem. I'm good at directions. I like directions a lot. I spend way too much time thinking about it, studying it. That's the type of, next year, Rabbi Teretsky, put that in the introduction, please. That is, if I'm not good at many things in life, but I'm really, really good at direction. Happened not to be, just while we're on the subject, this is really a tangent that I'm not sure we have time for. There's one person I know, there's a colleague of mine, and his nickname for the past decade or so has been GPS. That's what we call him, to his face, behind his back. If you have a question about something, you ask GPS. The first time I went on a recruiting trip for Reishit Yerushalayim, I traveled to the great city of Toronto. Those of you in Toronto may or may not appreciate this story more or less. But I got to Toronto, and I was there, and there already were GPSs at that time. Anyway, I landed in Toronto. I went to a school. It was now the afternoon. I was going to another school in Toronto, and I get a call on my cell phone from an Israeli number. It's this colleague of mine, and he says, where are you? So I'm like, that's a weird question. You think I'm playing hooky on the school's money or anything? I'm in Toronto. You know I'm in Toronto. He said, no, where in Toronto are you? I said, oh, okay. I'm telling you how my day goes. I'm in between this school and that school. He's like, no, where exactly in Toronto are you? So I'm like, I'm on Bathurst. I'm on the main street in Toronto, traveling from one school to the other. He's like, okay, where on Bathurst are you? So I tell him I'm on Bathurst over here. So he takes a deep breath and he's like, okay. And then he starts giving me to the second GPS coordinates of everything that I'm going. He's like, okay, coming up on your left side is the best bagel store in Toronto. That's exactly where you want to go on your way back if you want to get a good bagel. Sometimes the Danishes are a little bit stale. On the next block over, as I'm going, he's like, on your right side, look quickly, are you going to miss it? There's good parking for the supermarket. He's giving me play-by-play from Israel on every step along the way. He's the only guy I know in the world who's better at directions than I am, and still you might not care, just have to throw that in there. But I am very, very focused, very excited about directions, probably more so than I should be. Let me tell you something that happened to me shortly after we made Aliyah. It frustrated me. One of the things that held us back from making Aliyah is that I also like to talk, and I'm a fan of language, and I'm a lot better and more comfortable in English, especially when I made Aliyah, than I ever was in Hebrew. Shalom Aleichem, Kvod Harav, great to see you. Was very much more comfortable in English than I was in Hebrew, and I was worried about, as a teacher, as a father, as just a member of society, that I would have a hard time expressing myself as clearly in Hebrew as I did in English. And one of the areas that I was most concerned about was in the area of directions. Directional Hebrew happens not to be the easiest part of Hebrew. The first thing you learn is how to order a shawarma and tell them to put extra onions in it. We could all do that. Even if your Hebrew is very basic, you can navigate around the restaurant. For some reason, a lot of the Ulpans, because we spend a lot of time in restaurants, Ulpans start with how to call a waiter and how to ask for a check. We could do that relatively easily. Giving directions, try it if you want, giving directions is a little bit harder. You really have to be good at Hebrew language. Traffic lights, traffic circles, go past, right turns, left turns. These aren't the easiest parts of the language to master. And I found myself frustrated by the fact that I wanted to tell people and give people direction. This is not a metaphor for chinuch. This is just my weird desire to share people my knowledge of directions, nothing more than that. And I was frustrated that people would ask me, do you know how to get to such and such place? And I would know exactly how to get to such and such place. I had no problem with that, but I had no way to communicate it to them. And in the first years, the first months for sure, after making Aliyah, I had a dozen or more situations stopped on the street, or there'd be a worker man in the house and say, okay, how do I get out of here now? And I would know the answer and wouldn't be able to express it. And I worked on it. I tried to give myself the type of language skills that were going to allow me to communicate properly about directions. There's one Simchas Torah, a couple of years after we made Aliyah, my parents made Aliyah, they live in a nice neighborhood in Yerushalayim. There's one Simchas Torah, I was sitting in front of my parents' apartment in Yerushalayim, and I knew I had been working for so long on my directional Hebrew, on my ability to give directions in Hebrew, and I have to add that I felt there was a particularly strong mission that I had to be able to give directions in Hebrew, because I felt, with a little bit of a American bias, that Israelis are really, really bad at directions. You all know this as a general rule, and you know that if you ask any Israeli how to get anywhere, what are they going to tell you? Yashar, yashar, just, you know, they're going to point and give you some type of extremely vague. And I'm like, listen, this is probably why we made Aliyah. This is why God has directed our life to this point, because the Israeli society, I don't know if I can contribute anything in the field of education, politics, technology, medicine. I'm not a doctor, but I'll tell you how I can help Israeli society. I'm going to fix their giving directions. I'm going to wow the average Israeli, anybody who asks me, I'm going to be able to provide them with stuff they've never even dreamed of. It's going to be great. And sure enough, after working hard, I'm ready to roll this out. And I'm sitting, I wasn't this bad. I wasn't like Avram Avinu waiting to do chesed. I wasn't sitting outside my parents waiting for someone to ask me. I happened to be outside my parents' apartment, and an Israeli fellow walks by, and he happens to ask me, do you know how to get to this and this shul elsewhere in Yerushalayim? And I surely did know how to get. And I take a deep breath. And I'm ready to go, and I'm ready to take all my well-practiced Hebrew and able to give it over to him, and I'm trying as hard as I can. And I give him these really detailed directions that are utterly and completely incomprehensible because my Hebrew still stinks. I'm falling over my words, and I'm contradicting myself in what I'm saying, and I'm calling left, right, and right, left, and none of it is making any sense. And the more I realize that, the more flustered I get, and the more I'm tripping over my words, and I'm sounding really like an idiot, and the whole thing isn't going well, and I'm ready to give up the whole thing. And I'll be eternally grateful, because the guy was extremely sympathetic, he was extremely kind, but also insightful, as you'll hear in a minute. He puts his hand on my shoulder, and he says to me two things. First, he says to me, I speak English. That's the first thing he says to me, and he's like, you can give me whatever you want, we can have this conversation in English if you're more comfortable. I'm like, you could have told me that a couple of minutes ago, I would have been a lot happier. He's like, number one, I speak English. He said, number two, we could save each other both a lot of time. He says to me, and listen carefully to what he says to me, is it that way? Am I going in the right direction? And I said, oh, yeah, that's easy. I could do that in any language, or I could just point to you. Yes, it's that way. He says, thank you. Have a great Yom Tov. I'm like, wait a second. You speak English. I can give you a lot more. I could tell you it's that way, and then the third way. I could tell you to the color of the door that you're going to pass where you need to make a right through an alley, and I could give you all the landmarks and the descriptions. I could give you all of that. But it was clear to me, he didn't need to explain to me that he didn't want all of that. He didn't care about all of that. I'll tell you something remarkable about our Israeli cousins. This is a secret that I learned that day, that Simchas Torah, from this fine Israeli gentleman who spoke fluent English. Israelis are not bad at directions. They simply use directions in a different way than we do. They don't pretend that they know everything about every story and about everything that's going to come their way. They don't pretend that they know of that all the time. When they say yashar, yashar, they mean the most important thing for you to know is that right now you are headed in the right direction. Right now you have a destination and you are walking, you are taking steps in the right way to reach that destination. What's going to happen 9 steps from now, what's going to happen 20 minutes from now, is not their concern and is not their focus. And that's true for two reasons, one of which we're going to focus on for our remaining time this evening. The other one is important also, which I'll start with. First of all, Israelis are very social people. They don't believe, when you're in America, you know, you have this notion of the open road in Nevada or New Mexico that says last rest stop for 5,000 miles. And we tend to be socially more closed people coming from North America and the like. An Israeli knows you're stopping this person over here, and it'll take me 7 steps before I stop the next person. I'm going to roll down my window, and I'll ask another person, and they'll all get me there like a fire brigade. I'll be handed off from one person to the next person to the next person. I don't need directions for life because there's a more social, cohesive nature to the types of interactions that you have rolling down a window, yelling out of your car, or speaking to someone on the street. That's a discussion for a different day. But the other difference in their philosophy and in their approach, the other reason why Israelis are content with Yashar Yashar, that's what they give you and that's what they're looking for, is the simple reality that they understand the significance of having a point of focus, and they understand the significance of having in life a direction. Of knowing that the things that we are doing in life are designed to steer us in a certain direction, and that we need the type of guiding light and the type of examples that provide for us goals and destinations for the journeys that we take. I want to share with you a few extraordinary insights and ideas into different Mamari Chazal, into different teachings that we have in the Gemara and the Medrash. And I want to use these insights kind of in a consistent way to bring out this point of how critical, and not just critical, but how often this is an elusive part of the avoda, of the work that we do throughout our opportunities for growth in a year in Israel and the like, and certainly throughout the month of Elul and the process, the times of tshuva. There is a very, very cryptic line in the Gemara, which sounds exciting, and it sounds like something good until you think about it, and you realize what a bizarre message it actually is. It's a relatively well-known passage in the Gemara in Erevin, and the Gemara in Erevin records different Amoraim who delivered words of advice and insight to their various Talmidim. In one particular instance, the famous and great Amora Shmuel is speaking to his Talmud Rav Yehuda. And the advice, the life lesson that Shmuel chooses to teach his Talmud Rav Yehuda is a most unusual one. Shmuel says to his Talmud, Chatof ve'chol, chatof v'ishti. Whatever you do in this world, grab and eat, grab and drink. Make sure that you get your full of this world. Da'alma da'azlinon minei kihilula dami. Because the world in which we are ultimately going to leave, the world that we are a part of, kihilula dami, it is one big party. It is one big celebration. Hilula in the Gemara, significantly, almost always means a wedding celebration. The world that we live in is one big celebration. Grab and eat, because all of life is a party. Now, you think right away, and it has to be, that this is some kind of metaphor again. But what type of metaphor is it? The notion of life is a party is not the type of thing you'd expect to hear in a shir in this space medrash. It's not the type of thing you'd expect to read in a Musar Sefer or in the works of Rav Dessler or the Ramchal. It's not the type of thing you'd expect to be hanging above the door before you walk into the Old City or the Kotel. Take what you can, because this world is a party is a mantra and a philosophy of places far different than this one, of societies, of cultures, of environments, very different than the one we find ourselves in right now. So what does the Gemara mean when it says, what does Shmuel mean when he says to his dear Talmud, grab what you can, because the entire world is a party? So the simple explanation, and no doubt there is truth to this simple explanation, many of the Rishonim adopt this explanation, is that the world is a party only means that the world is an opportunity. It means that the world is full of great and beautiful things. And this Gemara's message, Rebbe to Talmud, is the message that we have heard that many people in all sorts of areas of society have discussed and spoken about. The Latin for carpe diem, seize the day, recognize that this is fleeting, take what you can, obviously of good things, obviously of meaningful things. Eating and drinking is some kind of metaphor for learning Torah, for acts of chesed. Do wonderful things while you can, because this party, and life is a party, party in the sense that it's full of good things and it's full of wonderful things. This life is a party, and the party has an expiration date. The party doesn't last forever. So if they take out a tray of poppers, if they're giving out hummus and carrots, and you really want to take some of that, so grab while you can, because it's not going to be there forever. They're going to dim the light soon. They're going to ring the bell soon. Whatever other metaphor you want to give for the party coming to an end, the clock is going to strike 12. The opportunities that we have will not last with us forever. So we are best to take advantage of them while we can. In fact, this would be an apt metaphor and an apt piece of advice for anyone beginning their Shana Aleph experience in a wonderful institution like Shalvim for Women. Come in and understand that the table that is set in front of you, with whatever challenges it may entail, with whatever difficulties may be involved in the beginning of the year or an acclimation, the table that is set in front of you is the opportunity of a lifetime that does not last for a lifetime. That's one of the reasons why it's the opportunity of a lifetime. It is a chance to do things, to experience things, to learn in a way that you will not be able to perpetually. Life will take over with other sets of responsibilities and distractions. This is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. Chatov ve'achol, chatov ve'ishti. Grab and eat, grab and drink. Another shiur, another conversation, another commitment, another project, the likes of which I'll never be able to do, because life is like a party. Parties have expiration dates, and it becomes a very, very appropriate and nice message. While there is no doubt, as I said, that the message rings true and that the message is appropriate, the metaphor is a little bit contrived. Couldn't Shmuel have come up with a better way of saying carpe diem and seize the day than his exclaiming proudly that life is a party? Grab and eat and grab and... It just sounds still so coarse. It's just a strange... This is not a helpful metaphor. Metaphors are there to elucidate, to clarify, to help us understand. This metaphor seems to obfuscate it, seems to make it more confusing, seems to hide the message a little bit with the coarseness of the language. Grab and eat, because life is a party. Again, why be so confusing if that is your message is simply the one of life is short, grab your opportunities while you have them. A few years ago, one of the great treasures of the internet is that they took many of the written drushos of a number of Rabbanim, but particularly of Rabbi Dr. Norman Lamb, the long-term chancellor and president of Yeshiva University, and they put his drushos, his written drushos, I have a version of one right in front of me right now, from a typewriter that he typed on. He gave this drusha twice in shuls in Manhattan. He gave this drasha quoting this Gemara, asking this very question, and quoting from some of the great works of Hasidus, the answer I'm about to share with you. He gave this drasha twice, once in 1964, quite a few years ago, and then 5 years later, this is significant for reasons you will hear in just a second, he decided in 1969, September Rosh Hashanah of 1969, he decided to give the drasha a second time. He decided to repeat the idea and to explain it, and you'll hear why. If you know anything about your American history, you'll understand why he decided 5 years later in 1969 to repeat it again. And Rabbi Lamb suggests a second approach, a different approach, to what this Gemara is implying and what this Gemara is telling us. The comparison of a life and the comparison of the world we live in and the opportunities that we have as a wedding doesn't just mean, it doesn't merely mean that life is full of delicacies and joys and pleasures and wondrous, wondrous opportunities in ruchnias and in gashmias, in physicality and in spirituality. No, says Rabbi Lamb. It means something more than that. A wedding is a very, very specific and unique kind of party. A wedding is something which requires, encourages, at the very least, all sorts of behaviors. For us to dress in a certain way, for us to eat certain things that are really wedding food, the type of smorgasbord, carving station, main course options and selections that you might have, to dance in a way that we wouldn't otherwise dance. And we do this all for a particular purpose. We do this because at the middle of all of that is the unique and powerful celebration of the union of Chasan and Kala. The fact that somebody and somebody else are choosing to get married, and we are celebrating that with all of the fanfare and all of the trappings, all of the party that is associated with a wedding like that. I'm sure if you've ever been to a wedding, and I imagine that more than a few of you have been, so you know that probably that there is in a normal American wedding, a five, six hour affair. So a lot of it is incredibly awesome. A lot of it is incredibly elaborate and extravagant and maybe overdone. And there is almost inevitably in a wedding, there is a 45 minute or more stretch of extreme awkwardness. That 45 minute stretch of awkwardness is when the chasan and kala are in the yichud room and then taking pictures. And when people have to entertain themselves at a wedding without a wedding to celebrate. There's no chuppah, there's no bedekin, there's no dancing, there's no congratulations. All there is some kind of funky salad, and then there's band music, specific songs that they play only when there is no chasan and kala there. Depending on the alcohol intake, there always are a few people, awkwardness level rising slowly, who try and attempt to get the dance circle going prior to the emergence of the chasan and kala. Hey, the band's on the bill, the band's on the clock for 6 hours, they're playing music, there's a dance floor, I got my dancing shoes on, why not just dance around? And I'm not suggesting that there's anything wrong with it. I certainly am more than suggesting that there is something a little bit awkward about it. There's nothing wrong with it. If that's what floats your boat and you're a big dancer and you're with your friends and you want to dance without the chasan, without the kala, that's fine. But that moment in time, those moments, those 45 minutes, that hour, highlights exactly what Rabbi Lam is speaking about. There is such a thing as a wedding, a celebration at a wedding, and there is such a thing as a wedding without a chasan and kala. We've all been there, those 45 minutes. And it's an uncomfortable, awkward type of feeling. There's something confusing about that dancing. Like, I'm getting into it, and listen carefully to the words that I'm using. This is not an entertaining metaphor. This is a very, very precise metaphor. I'm dancing around, but if I stop myself for a minute, or if someone tapped me on the shoulder and asked me the question as to why am I dancing all around, I wouldn't really be able to tell them. I don't know why I'm jumping up and down. There's no chasan and kala at the middle of the circle to justify, to explain the behaviors that I am doing. And Rabbi Lam writes such a beautiful, but unfortunately, I think for us, the beauty of it is almost overshadowed by the way in which it captures so much that we struggle with and so much that it is a challenge for us. He says the following, I'm reading you his exact words. It is no exaggeration to say that especially we of the 20th century, the only part of this that I would correct is that it's we of the 21st century, even more so than the 20th century of the 60s. It is no exaggeration to say that especially we of the 20th century stand in great need of this teaching that Alma Kihilula Dami, that the world needs to be compared to a wedding, that life is worth living only if it makes sense, that it makes sense only if there is a purpose, and that purpose is loyalty to God. The wedding of our talents and substance and destiny with the will of God as taught in Torah. We dance around in circle after circle. We engage in all sorts of activities, and every once in a while in our lives, someone taps us on our shoulder and says, why? Someone questions the ultimate motive and goal of the behaviors that we're engaging in. With a good answer, and the purpose is loyalty to God, the wedding of our talents is substance destiny with the will of God is taught in Torah. With the right answer, life becomes as sweet as that apple and the honey. Life becomes this incredible celebration of enjoyment and of purpose and of purpose and of enjoyment as we embark on a journey to grow, to understand towards a clear destination. Without that, sooner or later, misery and depression and frustration creep in to even the most holy and religious of the acts that we do. I'll return to the words of Rabbi Lamb. For we moderns, people in the modern world, have developed as never before the perfection of means. Science, the exploitation of nature, is a highly refined skill. Business, commerce, and trade are complicated arts. Communication and transportation, talking in 1964, communication and transportation are effected with consummate speed. We know how to do things like never before. How much more so this is true for our generation and our technology and our devices. We know how to do things like never before. The trouble is, we do not always know why we are doing them. We have an elaborate technology in which we are so intoxicated with means that are efficient that we have forgotten the ends. Never before have we been able to go so fast. Never before have we been so unsure of where it is we want to go. And here in 1969, he adds, we can land a man on the moon, but after having done so triumphantly, we begin to wonder what we are doing there in the first place. This is what Rabbi Lamb writes in 1969. It applied more in 1969 than it applied in 1964, and it applies more in 2016 than it applied in 1969. We rush and we run, and here's the most frightening part. As true as it is about technology, as true as it is about air travel and transportation, it's even more true, often, sadly, tragically, about our Avodas Hashem. What I just described is true not just about the research and development wing in Apple, but it's true about this space medrash and all but the medrash like it. What I just described, quoting Rabbi Lamb, never before have we been able to go so fast. I have the Torah world at my fingertips. I could accomplish things I've never dreamed of accomplishing in learning and in service of God, in davening and in acts of chesed. Never before have we been so able to go so fast. Never before have we been unsure of where it is we want to go. We act and we run and we sing and we dance and we celebrate without clear direction, without clear focus on exactly where it is we want to go, about what the purpose is of all of it, about what stands at the middle of the circle of our lives. There is, of course, a second dimension to this. Of course, there is the knowledge and the understanding of the overall goal, and then the next level of success comes in putting forward the steps that it requires to reach that ultimate goal and to reach that final goal. I'll explain to you now, quote to you at least, an explanation of a Gemara that at first glance may steer us in the opposite side of things, towards the opposite direction, but I'm going to suggest humbly that it's really talking about the exact same thing. The Gemara in the beginning of Maseches Brachos, the Gemara in Daf Gimel of Maseches Brachos, tells us again, somewhat bizarre story and exchange that takes place between Rabbi Yehuda and Eliyahu HaNavi. Excuse me, Rabbi Yossi and Eliyahu HaNavi. The Gemara records that Rabbi Yossi, once upon a time, is walking along the way. Amar Rabbi Yossi, Pam, once upon a time, Pam Achas, Hayisi Mahalich Baderach, I was traveling along my way, V'nichnasti L'chorva Achas, Mechorvos Yerushalayim L'hispalel. I came across a ruins of Yerushalayim, and I entered into it to grab a mincha. I entered into it to daven. Bo Eliyahu Zachor Latov. Eliyahu HaNavi himself came to greet me when I came out. V'shomar li al Pesach. He watched by the door to make sure nothing bad would happen to me. Waited till I finished davening. And he says to me, Bini, Mipnei ma nichnasta l'churva? What were you doing in there? Why were you in this fallen building? Why were you in this ruins? Amarti lo, l'hispalel. I went in there to daven. Vo amarli, and he said to me, that's not a good place to daven. All sorts of bad things can happen there. Hayolucha l'hispalel baderech. You should have davened mincha on the road. You should have stopped and davened on the street without going into that building. Amarti lo. I said to him, Misyarei ha'isi shema yasiku bi ovrei drachem. I was worried that other travelers were going to stop me and they were going to interrupt me. And then he explains to me, Eliyahu HaNavi, well, you could have davened a quick davening, you still should have done other things. And Rabbi Yossi goes on to recant all the things he learned from this exchange with Eliyahu HaNavi. And the story cries out for some sort of deeper explanation. What's really going on here? Why is Eliyahu HaNavi encountering Rabbi Yossi? What is Rabbi Yossi really doing and what is Rabbi Yossi really worried about? The great commentator on the Agadotas of Gemara, the Ben Ish Chai. The Ben Ish Chai has an extraordinary and unbelievably perceptive insight into this Gemara. The Ben Ish Chai observes that there is a very, very subtle shift in language that we find in this Gemara. And this is so often one of the great things that our modern culture has given us is that shows on TV, if you've ever heard of that, like CSI and the like, they teach you that when you investigate something, and it's very Talmudic, the tiniest little shift in evidence, the tiniest little point, if you tug at it, if you see what it has to reveal, there are entire worlds that can open up in front of you. The Ben Ish Chai observes that in the Gemara that I just quoted to you, the Gemara that I just read to you, there's a very, very subtle shift in language. A very, very subtle change in the words that the Gemara uses. And this seemingly insignificant shift, this seemingly insignificant change makes all of the difference in the world. This seemingly insignificant shift is literally the difference between success and failure in all of our journeys, in all of our efforts. Rabbi Yossi begins the story by saying that one day, once upon a time, he was outside of his normal course of action, his normal events, he was traveling. The words that the Gemara uses are, Pam achas ha'yisi mehalech bedrachim. If I asked any of you to translate mehalech bedrachim, you would tell me that it refers to a person who is traveling. When Eliyahu HaNavi engages him in conversation, and Rabbi Yossi has to explain himself, Rabbi Yossi once again refers to travelers. I was worried that my fellow commuters, I was worried that the other people on the LIRR, I was worried that the other people in the airport were going to interfere with my prayer. They were going to distract me, they were going to heckle me, maybe they beat me up, whatever it is that they were going to do. But these individuals, these travelers, are not called mehalchei drachim. He does not say he was worried about his fellow travelers. He changes the language so subtly and such a tiny way. He refers to ovrei drachim. Ovrei drachim, again, people who go on a path. Mahalech drachim, ovrei drachim. If you stopped an Israeli on the street right now and asked them for directions, tell me what they say, but that's not for now. If you stopped an Israeli on the street right now and you asked that Israeli, what is a mahalech bederach? They would say it's a person who goes on their way. What's an ovrei derach? It's a person who goes on their way. Not so, says the Ben Ish Chai. There is a world of difference, and we all choose what type of traveler we will be. There is a mahalech bederach, and there is an over derech. An over derech skips as they walk. An over derech doesn't have the steps, the organized focus on life that puts them in a particular direction, step after step, towards the reaching of a particular goal. The over derech is frenzied. The over derech goes in a million different directions. They literally skip steps over derech. They are above and beyond. They transcend, and not in a good way, the journey that they are supposed to have. The mahalech bederech is a person who goes methodically, in a thoughtful way, step after step, on a journey that will be incredibly rewarding and incredibly productive and incredibly meaningful. The person who is a mahalech bedrachim doesn't ignore the signs on the road, doesn't ignore the things that happen to them. They know exactly where they are right now, they know exactly where they want to be, and they have a clear roadmap of how to get there. They know the next step that they need to take. They know the direction in which they wish to head. The Over Derech doesn't get rewarded or commended for having their eye on the ultimate prize, but they understand that success in life depends on having a goal and having a roadmap to reach that goal. The roadmap need not be overly specific. The roadmap need not be full of details that we can't possibly know right now. But is what I am going to decide to do tonight going to bring me closer to the clear goal that I have, that center of the circle that Rabbi Lamb so beautifully described? Then I'm doing well and I'm doing great. It doesn't make a difference how quick I get there. It doesn't make a difference how many setbacks I have, but I am on the road. I am a Mahalech V'drachim. The Over Drachim is the one who says there isn't really a road. There is an aimlessness. There is a lack of focus. There is a lack of direction that dominates and defines my religious existence. And that is doomed to the worst kind of failures. That is destined to have with it the worst kind of disappointments. There used to be a feature, maybe they still have it. I don't even know if Newsweek magazine exists, let alone what features they have. There used to be, Newsweek used to come to our house, big magazine, and they used to have a feature that was the most popular feature of the magazine. It was on one of the first 7 or 8 pages. It was called Conventional Wisdom. They took a topic of the day, a politician, sometimes a celebrity, and all they did was put an arrow by the person's name. Not going to tell you whether this person is great or whether this person is terrible, whether this person is a hero, whether this person is a villain. I'm just going to tell you whether this person is a little bit better or a little bit worse than they were a week before. They put arrows. That was their way of assessing something. If you are a stock investor, if you care about the financial markets, then you know that that's what matters. A graph that tells you the performance of a stock is only as significant as the last little point and the arrow in which it's pointing at. The direction in which it is going. The stock could be $3 a share or $30 a share, but I want to know, is the $3 share going to be $3 and a cent tomorrow? Is the $30 share going to be $29.99 tomorrow? Because that makes a big, big difference in my investment strategy. Almost as much, if not more of a difference than whether it is 30 or 30, is whether tomorrow it's going to be $3 and a cent or $29.99, because the direction matters so much in defining its value and predicting its future. The direction tells you as much as the value itself does, and that's the point of focus that we need to have. There is a tefillah, a pasuk in Chumash, that we quote multiple times a day when we recite Kriya Shema. The second paragraph of Kriya Shema, V'hayayim Shemoa, tells us those words, if it will be, when it will be, that you will listen to the word of God. So we are told of all of the wonderful things that will happen to us. It is the ultimate description in the Torah of the world of Schar V'onesh. There are repercussions for the choices that we make, for the actions that we do. Do bad, horrible things will happen. Do good, great things will happen. A little bit of Parsha Sashavua, the Tochacha, and the Brachos and the Klolos that we read about in this week's Parsha Kisavo are a longer version of the ideas that are stated in multiple places in the Torah, including when we read the Parshios of Kriya Shema, V'hayayim Shemoa. What are the rewards? What does God promise us will be waiting for us if we do everything that we're supposed to do? If a person takes advantage of the opportunities that we began with, that we described before, if a person is serious about investing their time wisely and making decisions that bring pride and joy to their parents, to their community, to their God, if a person does right and a person does well, if a person leads a righteous life and a noble life, so what does God promise is going to happen? Hopefully you all know these words by heart. V'nasati mitar artzachem b'ito, Yoreh u'malkosh, God promises a lot of good and great rain. He promises that there is going to be rain coming, prosperity and goodness following everybody at all times. There are at least 4 points of frustration in reading those words day after day. And I'll say them in order, but feel free to play along at home. And how many of those, if we really think about it, here comes the big payoff. What's going to happen if you take full advantage of this year? What's going to happen if you follow every word of advice that you get from your greatest madrichah and your greatest teachers? What's going to happen if you live your life in the most exalted of ways? So I'm just quoting from the Torah. I'm telling you God's words themselves. V'nasati mitar arzachem b'ito yorat u'malkosh. Number one, it's a little bit of a letdown. It's a little bit of a letdown. The great reward, I mean, you would think that we would have graduated past a prosperous year of agriculture. We're going to have incredibly ripe watermelon. You can like watermelons as much as the next person. I'm very fond of watermelons. Mangoes are delicious. It's the right time of year. You go to a makolet, you can have a mango. It's absolutely great. The reward that we receive for such great activities, events, decisions, the reward that we receive for living our lives the proper way is agricultural prosperity. And I know, we'll get to it in a minute, I know that agriculture is just a code word for finance. Finance is a fancy word for money. That makes even less sense. So good, we're not talking about mangoes. We're talking about Lexuses. We're not talking about mangoes. We're talking about high-rise apartments and weekend stays in the Waldorf. That's more comforting. That's what the sentence should end with. You're going to have an economically viable startup nation, high-tech society where there are a lot of jobs and everybody's making lots of money. That's a very strange pot to have at the end of the rainbow. Number two, as we said, that's not a great code word for prosperity. Rain and drought. Drought is bad for sure, but Israeli society today and world society for sure is less dependent on agriculture and certainly on rainfall than it ever has been before. We manufacture all sorts of things and our economy depends, ours meaning Israel's and ours meaning the Western world. It's dependent on a lot of things. So even if financial prosperity would be great, I mean, again, why emphasize the rain and the agriculture? It seems a little bit dated. We need to remind ourselves every day, three times a day, when we recite Kriya Shema, Shachris, Maariv, Kriya Shema, Lamita. We need to remind ourselves all the time how the Torah is like, we gotta edit it a little bit. It doesn't really mean rain, it really means prosperity. And again, why does prosperity matter at all? On the technical word level, V'nasati mitar artzichem yorat u'malkosh. The Gemara Maseches Tanis describes what each one of those words mean. There are a lot of different kinds of rain. We get it. There are a lot of different kinds of rain. Do we really need to specify all three types of rain that exist? And the Gemara Tanis describes this and discusses this. Matar means one thing. Yoreh means another. Malkosh means another. Not all rain is good and not all rain is welcome. Don't worry, in case you were worried, sitting there davening, Maariv at night, don't worry, we're talking about the good rain and all three types of good rain and the good rain at the proper time. Enough already with the rain. And fourthly, if you're going to be talking about rain so much, what happened to normal rain? Normal rain, of course, is called Geshem. We daven Mashiv Aruach U'morid HaGeshem. We don't daven Mashiv Aruach U'morid HaMatar. We don't daven Mashiv Aruach U'morid HaYoreh U'morid HaMalkosh. There's a word for rain. If you are insisting and speaking about rain. Just say Geshem. But Geshem is nowhere to be found over there. Well, it's not a fifth question, but it is a fifth observation. Two of those three words, at least two of those three words, Matar and Yoreh, have something else in common other than the fact that they have to do with rain. The word Matar is the same exact word in ancient Hebrew and in modern Hebrew. It means both rain and what else? Who's a Hebrew knowledgeable person here? That's not English, but who knows their Hebrew well? What does the word Matar mean other than rain? That is correct. A matara is a goal. You reach your destination and your goal. Yoreh, besides being this form of rain, and the Gemara Tana says it derives, the rain derives from the fact that it penetrates and goes into the ground. What does Yoreh mean in modern Hebrew? Yud Vav Resh Hey? Anybody know what Yoreh means? It's probably good that you don't know. It's a little bit of a violent word. Yoreh means to shoot a gun. Yoreh means to aim or direct a projectile in a particular direction. Yoreh and Matar have much in common beyond the fact that they are both synonyms for rain. What the Torah is telling us is not only the fact that there will be financial prosperity, not only the fact that there'll be mangoes and watermelons, not only the fact that life will be pleasurable, enjoyable, the party that Rabbi Lam was speaking about, that the Gemara in Erevin discusses. What the Torah is telling us is that when a person dedicates themselves to a life of Torah and mitzvos, we will have the greatest, most beautiful and sublime prize and reward of all. V'nasati mitar ba'artzichem Yorat u'malkosh. You will have a life of purpose, and you will have a life of direction. You will find yourself surrounded by activities that have a goal, activities that have a purpose and a reason. You will not only excel at what you are doing, how quickly you are doing it, how efficiently you are doing it, but you will have clarity as to why you are doing it. You will feel yourself advancing every day closer to a goal. You will adopt for yourself not good practices, but guiding lights. The Torah that we learn, Torah, which is related to the word Yoreh, the Torah is a guide to us. We look to Torah not just as the Torah that we learn, not just the Torah that we study, not the Torah that hopefully excites us and energizes us and that we can enjoy, that we find to be sweet, delicious, and beautiful. But we look to Torah as a destination. I am heading towards there. I am going towards that. I'm aiming towards something. My life is built on steps towards a goal. My life is built on role models and behaviors that I am emulating. My life is built on a clear idea of where I am heading and why I am heading there. There are many, many awful mistranslations of common religious concepts that have crept into our English language and the way we talk about things. If I asked anybody in this room to define, to translate the word tshuva, so you would tell me, almost all of you would tell me right away that tshuva means? Who? Repentance. Okay, so let's just settle one thing right now in case you don't see me again for a long time. That's such a horrendous translation because not one person has a clue what repentance means. It just takes an English word that we don't know what it means, and there are fewer of those, and substitutes it for a Hebrew word that we don't know what it means. And you can engage in tshuva the entire time and someone stops you and asks you what you're doing. Oh, I'm repenting it all. And not only that, but repentance, whatever it does mean, ends up smacking of something. If you need to explain to someone what tshuva is, you'd end up describing to them yet another volume of self-help books in a special section in Barnes & Noble. I'm going to make a resolution to be a better person. That's great. That's important. That's a huge part of tshuva. Don't get me wrong. I'm going to shed a few pounds. I'm going to have healthier eating habits. I'm going to work out a little bit more. Okay, maybe tangentially related to tshuva, but not a direct connection for sure. I'm going to improve. That's really what tshuva is about. Can't I be happy and go home now? Well, no, that's also a mistranslation. Those all may be elements of what tshuva is, but in the contorted way that we described before, tshuva, in its literal definition, is directional. Tshuva only means to return. And it means to return, it means to go back to an original source, to go back to an original place, and tshuva is, most importantly, directional. Tshuva is what you say, what you do, when you are pursuing a particular destination. It means I'm going somewhere. I'm headed somewhere. I'm doing things for a very, very specific purpose and for a very specific reason. You know, we do this all the time when we have any sort of other goal. If I have a target for weight loss or a physical goal that I have for running a marathon, if I want to get into a good college or improve my SAT scores. So we know that's the goal, and I build an entire lifestyle around the steps that are required to achieving that goal. But very often, especially when we're overwhelmed by a wealth of opportunities and goodness, very often we lose that methodology, we lose that approach when it comes to our avodas Hashem. When it comes to our davening, when it comes to our learning, we do because it's in front of us, we do because it's there, we do because everybody else is doing, but we can't honestly say that we're on a path. We can't honestly say that we are mahalich b'derech. We can't honestly say that we're on a journey, we're doing tshuva, we're here and we're going back to there, we're going to a particular place. We can know that we're dancing around the circle, but we can't honestly say that we know why. I like to quote in this base medrash very often, and I know I shared this with some of you who were on some of the NCSY summer programs and that harrowing summer after your 10th grade, and we shared some experiences with some of you in this room that summer. But I have no idea if it's a true story, but to me it is so powerful in bringing across this very idea and the way we should be spending our time and what our focus should be. I just spent last week in America, and I landed in America a week ago Sunday. Once again, information about my life that you probably don't care about or need to know. But a week ago Sunday was significant because it was the 15th anniversary of 9/11. 15th anniversary, 15 is a nice round number. Every anniversary of 9/11, for those who were alive then and living then, it is probably much more than Memorial Day or July 4th. It's the most emotional day, I think, on the American calendar. Maybe Martin Luther King Day in certain segments of the population. It's the day that brings out the most depth and meaning in American society today. 9/11 memorials all over the place, people speaking. And I was, of course, reminded, I didn't need the 15th anniversary of 9/11 to be reminded. Elul reminds me of this every single year, of a story I read right after 9/11. Again, I can't for a minute tell you whether it's true, but I can tell you what a brilliant, brilliant depiction of some of the feelings and emotions of that time period in American history and some of the goals and objectives that we should have during the month of Elul. People remember many side points about 9/11 that defined the day's experience. Many people, including myself, remember clearly what a gorgeous day it was. What you call in New York or in any place in the world an Indian summer. A last gasp day of beautiful summer weather, but not too hot and not too humid. Mid-70s, not a cloud in the sky. Just the type of day that you would wish to end forever. It was the most ironic and worst type of canvas for the horrors of 9/11 to be painted on and projected on. That's one thing people remember. Another thing people remember is that it was the first day or days of school. I was teaching in Long Island at the time. I heard about 9/11 at a high school minion. Remember, it was the beginning of the school year. In one particular preschool, in one particular nursery in Lower Manhattan, not only was it the first day of school, but it was the first day of school for younger students, first day in their ever going to school in their lives. And you could imagine the type of pressures and burden that were placed on that preschool in the shadow of the World Trade Center, in the shadow of the Twin Towers, as all heck broke loose in the middle of their first day of school. And on top of everything else that everybody was dealing with, they had to account for all of the parents of these preschoolers to make sure that there's somebody to send them home to. They couldn't even have an early dismissal until they found out, and phone lines are down, and it's impossible to get through to anybody. They have to make sure these are all kids of adults, of people who were working in the financial district, working in Lower Manhattan. It was an absolute, absolute nightmare. They divide and conquer. Some of the teachers are responsible for keeping the kids happy, playing with blocks and Legos and dolls. Some of the teachers are working the phone. It's now 1, 2 o'clock in the afternoon, 4 or 5 hours after it happens, and they've accounted for everybody. They're ready to load the buses. The kids don't suspect a thing. There's commotion and sirens and smoke outside, but the kids think that's kind of cool. They get everybody organized. You don't know if there's anything else going on. We just got to get these kids home. Okay, kids, we're going to move a little bit quickly. Everybody get your lunchbox. Everybody go on the bus. One little boy, he gets outside, he's having a great day, everything's going well. He gets outside and he looks around, and it's true, it's a little bit crazy what's going on. Things don't look exactly the way they normally look. It's a little bit hazy and smoky, there's a little bit of debris, there's some shouting and yelling. It's disorienting, but the kid loses it completely. He starts wailing and crying uncontrollably. Teachers don't know what to do. You know, if you're a preschool teacher or a parent, sibling of young children, so you know there's a lot of different kinds of cries out there. You learn right away. Somebody's crying because his sister's pulling his hair. Someone's crying because they have a bee sting. Someone's crying because, God forbid, there's a much more sin. You know, this is a bad cry. Something is very, very wrong. Something's bothering this kid tremendously. They try to bribe him. They try to console him. These are professionals. Nothing is working. They get to his bus stop. He hasn't stopped bawling for a minute. They get to his bus stop. His parents are waiting anxiously. They just want to be reunited as a family. Parents are waiting anxiously at the bus stop. The father, who's stressed out beyond belief, he takes one look at his crying son and he says, "What did I pay you for? What did you do to him? What did you not shield him? Did you not protect him? What did you tell him? Did you tell my 5-year-old son about the horrors of the terrorist attack? What did you do?" The teacher says, "We swear to you, we didn't do anything. We don't know why he's crying." The father says, "Thanks for nothing." Grabs his kid, he goes home. School's canceled the next day. Friday morning, the teachers get a call. It's the father. The father says to him, I'm so embarrassed. I owe you a big apology. Spoke to my son, everything calmed down. It was such a crazy day. I took out all my frustration on you. I was way out of line. I know, I respect the work that you do. I know you were great with the kids. I know you were professional. I shouldn't have yelled at you. Apologize for everything. My bad, I'm sorry. Teacher says apology accepted. Crazy for everybody. What was he crying about? What was going on with your kid? The father says, I'm going to tell you very clearly. I'm going to tell you what happened. My wife and I, we figured it out. We had a great summer with our son. He loved every minute. He was home all the time. And we spoke every single day in excited terms about going to nursery, about going to kindergarten. You're going to go off to school. Everything's going to be great. You're going to love it. Gonna be, yeah, can't wait. How many days? A couple of days ago, before school started, we sensed in him. He started to get a little bit nervous. He started to get a little bit anxious. Psychologists call this separation anxiety. He's used to being with his parents in his house, with his nanny, whoever else. He's used to being in comfort all the time. Now he's going off to the big bad world. It's a scary, scary place. And finally, 9/11, 6:30 in the morning, I'm eating my Wheaties, reading the Wall Street Journal. My kid comes to me in his little sleeper with his blankie. He comes, you know, walking into the kitchen. Dad, I'm not going to school. I can't do it. I can't do it. Haven't been able to sleep. I'm having nightmares and having tremors. I don't want to go. I'm staying home. I don't want to go. Of course you want to go. It's going to be so much fun. You're going to make new friends. You're going to play with your toys. Everything's going to be great. I don't want to go. Father says, okay, just tell me what's wrong. What bothers you? He says, I'm excited. I want to do all of it. But I'm afraid that if I go there, I'm going to get lost. I'm good with going there as long as I come home every night. As long as I can make it back to you and I can make it back to mommy. What if I go there and I can't find my way home, and they don't know how to get me home? It's the fear of a five-year-old separation anxiety. Father has an enormous smile on his face. He's a good parent. Father says, that's what you're worried about? That's what you're scared about? Kid says, yeah, Dad, that's what I'm scared about. That's what I'm worried about. Father says, okay, you are the luckiest boy in the entire world. You are the most lucky kid I know. Kid says, why? Why am I so lucky? Father takes him by the hand, takes him out to their little porch outside the dining room, and he says, look up and tell me what you see. So I see the buildings. We're in the shadow. Battery Park City. We're in the shadow of the World Trade Center. You live next door to the most famous buildings in the world. You live next door to the tallest buildings in the world. Whenever you get lost in life, just look up and see the buildings, and you will know where you live, and you'll know how to go home. Kid wipes away his tears. He says, Dad, thank you. I can do this. I'm going to school. The whole world falls apart at 8:48 a.m. The kid is playing blocks and muttering to himself, just look up. Just look up and see the towers. Just look up and see the towers. The whole world is going crazy. Their bodies jumping off of buildings and buildings collapsing. And the kid is eating his peanut butter and jelly sandwich at his 10 o'clock break. And he's saying to himself, just look up and I'll find my way home. The whole world is wondering what's going to happen next. And the kid is just wondering what's going to happen when it's time to go home. Time to go home. They put on their coats. They do this fire drill, get onto the buses. And the kid has been waiting all day to look up and to see the buildings. And instead of the buildings, there's a void. Instead of the buildings, there's smoke. And it's not the sirens, and it's not the debris, it's not the haze, and it's not the smoke. None of that is what's disturbing him. But his guiding light and the source of his ultimate consolation, his direction, is lost to him. And the kid is inconsolable. That's why, says the father, that's why my kid was crying. That's why he was inconsolable. Because you can't live life without that center. You can't live life with that type of disorientation. You can't live life without. We can make all sorts of sacrifices. We can endure all sorts of struggle. We can deal with all sorts of difficulties if we know why. And if we believe that we're headed in a direction, if we are mahalich bedrachim, if we're going step by sometimes difficult step towards a particular goal, hoping to grow and hoping to achieve something and hoping to reach that destination. But the flip side is that the greatest pleasures of the world are bitter, and the greatest activities in the world don't mean anything when we don't have a goal and we're just kind of going through the motions and we're just doing it because it's in front of us. The process of tshuva is directional. The process of tshuva is highlighted by being mamlech HaKadosh Baruch Hu. That means putting him in the middle of the circle. It means establishing for ourselves a clear direction of where we are headed to, what our goals are, and which direction we wish to head. And that is the secret, I believe, of the avoda of the month of Elul, of the tshuva that we are trying to do. To establish for ourselves, to walk out of that davening, not having survived a davening experience, having made it through the machzor quickly, having heard a chazan with a good voice, having heard a beautiful speech or a nice idea. We end Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur and we say, I'm going to end this and I'm going to have a goal. I'm going to have a destination. I'm going to have my World Trade Center. I'm going to have the place that I look to so that I know where I am going. I am going to make sure that the dancing that I do is for a purpose. The eating I do is for a purpose. The steps that I take are in a particular direction, heading towards a great goal. And with that, even with setbacks and even with frustrations, we experience the greatest successes in the world. And even with whatever holds us back and whatever doesn't meet our greatest expectations, we know we're headed to a great place and we know we are oriented and in the proper direction. I wish all of us the greatest in Hatzlacha and having that experience and having that type of joy of the effort, of the journey, of being and embracing the status of a Mahalech B'drachim, and that road leads to ultimate happiness and fulfillment and leads us tshuva, the return to the embrace of the Ribono Shel Olam, the togetherness and the focus on God Himself and the purpose of our existence. Thank you very much. Sorry about the timing.
That's great.